Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. The COVID-19 global pandemic has taken the lives of more than 116,000 people around the globe. The virus has infected more than 1.8 million people, according to Johns Hopkins. In her latest piece in National Geographic, today's guest, Beth Gardner, says the virus is exploiting our biggest weaknesses, from creaking healthcare systems to extreme social inequality. Its relationship with one pervasive and neglected problem, however, is more tangled. Air pollution has intensified the pandemic, but the pandemic has temporarily cleaned the skies. Beth Gardner writes, when new evidence emerged this week that dirty air makes COVID-19 more lethal, it surprised no one who has followed the science of air pollution, but the scale of the effect was striking. She is referring to a recent study by Harvard University researchers. It looked at 3,080 counties across the United States and compared levels of fine particulate air pollution with coronavirus death counts for each area. And it found counties that have experienced a higher level of air pollution over the past 15 to 17 years have a substantially higher COVID-19 mortality rate. That means a one-unit increase in long-term average exposure to fine particulate matter is associated with a 15% increase in COVID-19 mortality rates on average. So who is most impacted by air pollution? We're seeing clear skies around the globe because those of us who can are staying inside. So what will it take to continue that trend? Beth Gardner is a journalist and author of the book Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. Beth's work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times and The Guardian. And Beth is a former longtime Associated Press reporter. And she joins us from London. Hi, Beth. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back, Beth. Before we dive in, since you're in London, I'm just wondering, how are you and your loved ones doing?
Oh, we're doing fine. You know, we're in lockdown. But it's this strange, I guess, like in a lot of places, this strange sort of jarring, discordance between the fact that you look outside and it's like just a gorgeous spring day and everything is in bloom. But, you know, there's this sort of horror show unspooling inside all the hospitals here. So, you know, but we're fine hanging in there. I hope you are, too.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing the best we can. And Boris Johnson has received, you know, international headlines because he was in the hospital. And so we've been looking at what's going on in England. What can you tell us about the number of cases there and, you know, what health providers and scientists expect in the coming weeks?
Well, you know, I think Britain is really not in a good situation right now. We seem to be following pretty closely the trend line of Italy, if anything, on an even steeper increase of deaths and hospitalizations. Obviously, I mean, it was so dramatically captured in the fact that the prime minister ended up in intensive care. You know, thankfully, he's now out of the hospital and seems to be recovering well. But that was a really jarring and scary moment for the country. And in fact, a number of other cabinet secretaries, members of the government, have also been sick. None were as severe as Johnson, but various heads of different major government departments have sort of dropped off at different times and had to go home and self-isolate with symptoms, as did the chief medical officer of the UK, sort of the British equivalent of Dr. Fauci. So, you know, it's been pretty scary. And I, you know, personally know really quite a large number of people who've been sick with COVID already. You know, no one who's been in the hospital, but just various friends and acquaintances, which kind of speaks to me to the fact that, like, it just tells you that it's spread so widely here already. And I think like New York and the New York area, Britain sort of dragged its feet a little bit on really aggressively imposing some of these social distancing measures that sort of, you know, mid to late March period. And I guess you guys out there in the Bay Area and California more widely now are benefiting from the fact that your political leaders, you know, the mayor and that whole coalition of Bay Area counties and Governor Newsom, too, really were ahead of the curve and implemented some pretty serious shutdown measures, you know, before things got really bad. And it does seem like places that did that are benefiting now, and places like New York, places like the UK that waited are paying the price. So that seems to me what's happening here.
Right. We're on now week four of our shutdown. And, you know, some people decided to stay home even before that because it was getting a lot of attention. And, you know, especially those of us who have older people in our lives didn't want to chance it. So it is interesting to see how that's playing out. And Beth, I was just looking at the Johns Hopkins site because they've got some great data. Gosh, almost 90,000 people just in the UK have confirmed cases, and you've got 11,329 deaths.
And the real numbers are actually so much larger than that because there's almost no testing here that's being done outside of hospital settings. Oh. So the vast majority of people are not counted, the vast majority of cases. And in fact, what we've learned over the past few days is that even the deaths number, which, you know, a lot of people have thought is a better barometer, because of course deaths are harder to miss than, you know, cases. Even the number of deaths is not a true reflection of reality, because deaths in nursing homes, which we're starting to realize are rampant. I think half of nursing homes in the UK now are thought to have the virus present in some way or another. Those deaths are not being recorded, nor are people who die at home. So yeah, those numbers are terrible, but I think they don't even capture the reality.
Wow. Beth, I'm wondering, last week in the United States, we saw so much reporting about how COVID-19 is really not the great equalizer. It's hitting communities of color, especially African-American communities, much harder than the rest of the population.
Yes.
We had a journalist from Spain on Friday's show who said the same thing. It's hitting the most vulnerable in Spain. What about Britain? Is this now, this angle getting more coverage?
Yeah, I think it's starting to, you know, and in fact, even within the National Health Service, the main medical healthcare provider here, I think the numbers have risen now. But as of last week, there were 19 healthcare doctors and nurses mostly who had died already of coronavirus. I think it's now somewhere close to 30. But at least in the first 19, I haven't looked at the more updated numbers. All of them were racial minorities and largely immigrants. I mean, the NHS medical staff does have a very large immigrant representation. But, you know, I think even within that healthcare community, we're seeing a real inequality. So, you know, I think it's very much of an issue.
Right. Well, let's talk about air pollution, Beth, because it's so connected to this. I mean, we had you on twice to talk about your book because it was so good. And there was just so much to cover because you went to so many different places around the globe.
Yeah.
Let's first talk about this Harvard study that you cited in your National Geographic piece. So this study looked at 3,080 counties across the United States, and the findings were pretty striking. As you said, for people who follow this, not too surprising, but still striking. What stood out for you?
Yeah, so it's funny. I actually wrote a story, a different article for Huffington Post about a week before the study came out. You know, and every air pollution scientist that you talk to will tell you that, you know, it's very clear that we know that air pollution causes a whole long list of health problems, from, you know, heart attacks and strokes, other kinds of cardiovascular, to breathing issues like asthma and COPD, which is an obstructive pulmonary issue, to diabetes and dementia. And all of these things, you know, as we are seeing play out now with the coronavirus, put you in a high risk category. If you have them, for suffering severely from the coronavirus. So, you know, before the Harvard study came out, when I was interviewing air pollution scientists, you know, they were saying very clearly that, you know, we're sure that air pollution is exacerbating the experience of COVID and raising the mortality rates. But, at, you know, before the Harvard data came out, the best sort of really hard studies that people could point to was some analysis that had been done in China around the SARS epidemic. There was a study that found that in the most polluted areas of China, the death rate from SARS was double what people were experiencing who had the virus in the least polluted areas. And we know that SARS is sort of the closest viral cousin of COVID-19. So, you know, it's the absolute logical conclusion of everything we know about air pollution and everything we know about COVID-19 to say that both long, you know, over many years exposure to air pollution and short-term exposure to air pollution sort of, you know, over the last week or few days will put you in a higher risk category if you get COVID of having serious problems with it. What the Harvard data did, this is a team, the senior scientist is a woman named Francesca Domenici, and she has been doing all kinds of analysis, you know, for years on air pollution data from around the country. So she has in her lab already a huge database of air pollution levels over the last 17 years from every county almost in the United States. So what she and her team did in very, very short order, this study was really, you know, put together remarkably quickly because they already had the data, was they combined the analysis of that data with the tracking of mortality and deaths that Johns Hopkins has been doing. And they were able to compare what are death rates like in counties where air pollution is high versus counties where air pollution is lower, all other things being equal. So these counties that are similar in every other way, you know, whether it's income levels or education levels or racial makeup or any of these things. And what they found is that the terminology used, the unit used in measuring the levels of these tiny particles, which are so dangerous to our health, is called micrograms per cubic meter. And what they found was that an increase of just one microgram per cubic meter, which is, you know, very small, was correlated with a 15% increase in the mortality rate of people who got COVID. You are 15% more likely to die from COVID if you get it, if you live in a county with just a one microgram per cubic meter increase. So I don't know off the top of my head the particle pollution level in the Bay Area, but just for reference, in New York, it's 11. So if it had been, you know, 12, the death rate would be 15% higher. If it had been 10, 15% lower over many years. So, you know, every scientist I spoke to before that study came out told me for sure air pollution is making this illness worse. But to me, what was so shocking was the size. Because, of course, if your county is, you know, 2 micrograms per cubic meter higher, you're 30% more likely. That's a big increase. So, you know, it's telling us that the air we are breathing over many years, we already knew was causing so many illnesses, you know, and driving up the overall death rate in the population. But now we know it's also driving up the death rate for people who get COVID. So, you know, that's pretty powerful data.
And we talked about this a lot when you were on last time and the time before, that even the smallest levels of air pollution can be deadly.
Yes, it's true. And, you know, that's a two-sided coin in a sense, because what it also tells you if you are, you know, sort of a political or regulatory official with the authority to make rules about pollution, whether it's rules on car companies or rules on power plants or anything else, is that the more you can push air pollution down, the lower you will push death rates down and the healthier the population in your region will be, you know, and that is why we know that when we move to, you know, clean technologies like wind and solar power and we move away from, you know, gas and coal and oil and when we move to electric vehicles instead of fossil fuel and you know, less driving altogether, more biking, more public transportation, the cleaner the air gets, even if it's already pretty good, you know, the healthier your population will become. So yeah, it's very powerful. And I think, you know, the numbers we were talking about from this Harvard study show you that just a tiny increase or a tiny decrease makes a very big difference for, you know, what people will experience if they get this virus.
And Beth, this is why it's so important to track what the Trump administration is doing when it comes to environmental rollbacks. We talked about this last Monday. Part of the show, we discussed the Trump administration rolling back a key Obama-era fuel standard intended to mitigate pollution. This is really important when it comes to air pollution.
Yes. So, and that is a longer term thing. So that applies to, you know, cars being manufactured in the future and what level of efficient, what mileage they'll have to achieve. And that is tremendously important. But another thing that has been happening sort of beneath the radar while we're all, you know, worrying about the virus is that the EPA has basically announced that they are suspending all enforcement of air and water pollution regulations right now while this pandemic is underway, you know, supposedly because it's too difficult for polluting companies, whether it's petrochemical facilities in, you know, along the Gulf Coast or power plants or, you know, what have you, too difficult for them to sort of manage the reporting or whatever. But it's not a, you know, statement to companies that if you have problems coping with reporting because of staff shortages in the pandemic, we'll consider, you know, giving you a break. It's just a blanket, you know, no reporting, no enforcement. It's interesting. I spoke to some scientists at the University of British Columbia up in Vancouver who were talking about clean air as a way of flattening the curve. You know, we all now are familiar with the concept of flattening the curve, slowing down transmission of the virus so that we don't overwhelm our healthcare systems. Well, what these scientists are saying up at UBC is that if we can get the air cleaner, that will also help to flatten the curve because, you know, you can't change what people have breathed over the last 15 years. But even bringing cleaner air now and what they've started doing up in British Columbia is putting restrictions on open burning, agricultural burning of, you know, farmers who oftentimes this time of year up there set fire to sort of all the last year's debris that's out in their fields to clear the fields. So they're putting restrictions on that now because we know that smoke, whether it's from that kind of a fire or from a wildfire or even from a fireplace in your home, is adding particulate matter to the air, and it's making people sick. And in a moment where we are in the middle of a health emergency, if you can, you know, reduce that pollution, you will not only ease complications from COVID, but you will reduce the number of heart attacks and strokes. And we know that dirty air days correlate with spikes in emergency room visits. So anything you can do to clean the air is a way to help ease the burden on the healthcare system right now in this moment of maximum pressure. And what we are seeing from the EPA, the Trump EPA, in saying to polluting industrial facilities, you know, factories, whatever, we're not enforcing the rules right now on pollution. It's exactly the opposite of flattening the curve. Hmm. So, you know, that will be a very consequential decision.
Today, we're speaking with Beth Gardner, journalist and author of the book Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. We're talking about the connections between air pollution and COVID-19 cases and deaths. To your point, Beth, about clean air, I mean, I've been reading about what's happening around the world, and it's really amazing. The New York Times had a piece a couple days ago. India savors a rare upside to coronavirus. Delhi residents are stunned by how blue the sky really is as a strict lockdown cuts back drastically on air pollution. And according to this piece, at night there are stars. During the day, the air is so clean that for once you can't taste it, free of the usual smoky metallic tang. I mean, you wrote about India in your book, and I mean, this is just such an amazing visual to think about.
It is. And, you know, people in India are saying they can see the Himalayas who never were able to see them before. Even where I am in London, you know, I've been going out biking into the center of London where I would never normally go because, you know, I'm terrified to fight the traffic. There's no cars on the roads now. And it's a very notable difference in air quality because here in the UK, as well as much of Europe, there's a lot of diesels on the road, diesel cars, and they, you know, if you've ever experienced diesel fumes, you know they're very, you know, you can smell it, the real thickness, and you can taste it. So it's very pleasant to be without that. But, you know, I have to say there's so much attention to this sort of idea that the lockdowns have reduced air pollution, they've reduced climate change. And honestly, it's really bothering me how people are constantly telling me, oh, you know, there's a silver lining. Obviously, the lockdowns are horrible, but, you know, at least the air's cleaner, at least carbon emissions are going down. And I really don't see it that way. I think it's a real red herring to focus on that. I mean, it's true, obviously, and you know, the numbers are dramatic, even in the Bay Area since the lockdown started. Levels of various pollutants from traffic and other sources are down by 25-30%. But what is that really telling us that we didn't already know? You know, sure, if you stop doing all the things that cause pollution, whether it's driving or flying or burning coal at Chinese factories or whatever, yes, the pollution will go down. Of course it will. But we know that as soon as things start back up, it's going to come right back. And I sort of feel like this constant focus on the idea of the shutdowns or reducing pollution, it sort of seems to carry this suggestion of like, there's no other way we could have possibly achieved cleaner air or lower carbon emissions than by, you know, a terrible disease that's killing thousands of people and, you know, devastating the economy. Obviously, we, you know, I hope maybe there's something we can learn from this just from the experience of knowing, you know, that air pollution is not inevitable. It's not necessary, but it does not logically follow that turning the economy back on has to mean, you know, we go back to our old dirty ways. I think it maybe raises the question. And one of the people I interviewed for that Nat Geo story said to me, you know, we need to think about what are the ways that we can achieve lower carbon, less pollution without shutting down the economy and, you know, stopping people from going anywhere and earning a living. And that obviously means, you know, clean energy and sustainable technologies and electric vehicles and all those things we know. You know, shutdowns, lockdown, pandemic, it's terrible, right? It's not a silver lining to me that air pollution is down. And, you know, I wouldn't want someone to read an article like that and think, oh, yeah, environmentalists are, you know, happy about COVID-19 because humans are somehow the enemy. You know, the reason people who care about air pollution, who care about climate change, the reason we care about those things is that we care about human well-being, right? So we need to find a way to maybe learn something from these clearer skies and the experience of, you know, not having an asthma attack when you go out for a walk along a busy road, and ask ourselves what can we change going forward, and do we have to go back to, you know, these old polluting ways?
Exactly. CalMatters reports that the Los Angeles basin, where the term smog was invented, has enjoyed the longest period of good air quality days since 1995. And before we go to break, Beth, I just wonder, do you think that this is giving people a taste of what is possible? And so maybe once we get through this, they will demand more from government when it comes to air quality and, you know, the climate crisis overall.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's possible. Certainly this pandemic is a huge moment of global crisis. And we do know that epidemics in general and global crises in general are, you know, sometimes historically moments of change and moments where we pivot. You know, I don't think any of us knows yet what all the ramifications of this experience are going to be and where it might take us and where we might want to go next. You know, I think it's important to realize that it's not automatic that we are going to learn those kinds of lessons. And historically speaking, recessions in general tend not to be good for the environment. Carbon emissions and pollution sometimes go down when economic production goes down, but they tend to bounce back even to a greater level than before. After the fact, we're already seeing that in China as they reopen. You know, environmental regulations, as we discussed, often get loosened during periods of economic crisis because there's a perception that, you know, we can't afford to sort of look after the environment or look after our health in the same way. You know, so I think that some of those dangers are present now, too.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Beth Gardner, a journalist and author of the book Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. On today's One Planet series, we're talking about the connections between air pollution and COVID-19 deaths. And we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about health inequities and the connections between air pollution and COVID-19 with Beth Gardner, a journalist and author of the book Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. And let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I don't think I would classify myself as potentially a disadvantaged resident, but compared to most people who live in Palo Alto where I live, I certainly am in that category. What I've watched over the last year is the city seemingly having a very cavalier attitude about air pollution and trying to do things that could change this. Now, I just want to give you an illustration and see if I can make this comparison to this COVID-19 that you're talking about. Right across the street from me, the city has been building a six-level parking garage, six stories. That's how much they're building. They're not even complying now with the orders to shut this thing down. It's been a shutdown for the last 10 days. And there's been significant pollution generated by this project. The city still allows people to burn wood. I was walking in a park the other day, and I could smell it, really thick smoke. Don't know why people are doing it in the afternoon at this time of the year. But it's amazing to me to see a city like this, which claims to be so liberal, going in what I think is the wrong direction. Instead of trying to solarize this whole community and go to renewable energy and try to deal with this issue of air pollution, here we are building this parking garage. And they've had a really cavalier attitude with regard to shutting down these construction projects in light of the orders, the public orders, requiring that people not only shelter in place, but that people practice safe distancing. So to me, there's a clear, I mean, I don't understand the attitude. It's just seemingly not consistent with what I understand about the medical indications that you talked about with regard to air pollution and the COVID-19.
All right. Thank you, Greg. Let's get a comment from Beth. What are your thoughts, Beth?
Yeah, I mean, certainly about the wood burning, you know, as I said, British Columbia has put restrictions on open burning for the duration of the COVID-19 pandemic because we know that the smoke from burning wood exacerbates health problems and exacerbates respiratory problems and is going to, you know, make people's COVID-19 experience worse and more dangerous. So, you know, I know that the Bay Area has these sort of spare the air day restrictions that they can sort of turn on and off to, you know, urge people not to or ban people from burning wood. It seems to me like that would be something that makes sense to help to flatten the curve right now and reduce the pressure on healthcare systems and help people be healthier. As far as building huge, you know, parking lots. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's maybe a good indication of what we were talking about before the break, which is that there's no guarantee that this, you know, moment of crisis, what may turn out to be a turning point, is going to end up with things turning in a direction that leads to more sustainability and greater health. There are a lot of very powerful forces of all sorts pushing in the other direction too, you know, not directly linked to what the caller was talking about. But, you know, we're seeing President Trump and others on the right try to use this pandemic to sort of exacerbate tensions between countries and, you know, build walls ever higher and accuse China of being at fault. So, you know, we don't know what consequences it might unleash. And there are a lot of forces pulling in different directions. And certainly, you know, a less sustainability and more pollution and more cars is a very possible outcome of this situation, too, particularly, you know, if people start to become fearful of public transportation. You know, we may see traffic and cars even worse and consequently air pollution and carbon emissions worse after this temporary lockdown situation ends.
Well, thank you for the call, Greg. That is Beth Gardner, journalist and author of Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. Now I would like to welcome Dr. Mustafa Santiago Ali to the show. Mustafa is Senior Vice President for Environmental Justice at the National Wildlife Federation and a member of the Environmental Protection Network. Mustafa Ali served as Senior Advisor for Environmental Justice and Community Revitalization and Assistant Associate Administrator for Environmental Justice at the U.S. EPA for more than two decades. And Dr. Mustafa Santiago Ali joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Mustafa. Thanks for joining us. Great to have you back.
No, thank you for having me, and thank you for focusing on these very important issues.
Well, I just wonder, first off, you're in D.C. How are you and your loved ones and your community doing right now?
Well, you know, everyone's doing the best they can. Unfortunately, my family was the first to lose someone in West Virginia. You know, most folks know I grew up in Appalachia and in Michigan, so I still have a lot of family there. And unfortunately, we lost someone, and we have another member of our family who's in the hospital fighting right now, but it's looking promising. So, you know, we just continue to push on.
Wow, I'm so sorry, Mustafa.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. You know, we just have to take this moment to really get focused and make sure that we are educating and putting a spotlight on the disparities that still continue across our country and getting and holding our, you know, elected officials accountable in this moment to do the right thing.
You know, Mustafa, we've had you on over the years. We've done so many shows about environmental justice. Your Twitter account is full of you doing videos about these issues. And, you know, we have known that Black communities, Indigenous communities, Latinx, the poor have been disproportionately affected by pollution and so many other environmental issues. What are your thoughts about what this pandemic is really exposing? Because the connections between COVID-19 deaths and communities of color, especially Black communities, have really started to get national media attention starting last week.
Yeah, and it, you know, it sometimes it's baffling when I see the president and others sort of share that they had no ideas that these systemic impacts have been going on, you know, for decades, but especially under our current administration, without them actually doing anything of substance to, you know, better prepare and to build the foundation that's necessary inside of the communities. You know, we've known and you know, frontline leaders and others have been sharing for decades about the deaths and sicknesses that have been happening inside of what we now talk about as our most vulnerable communities, communities of color, lower wealth communities, and also on Indigenous lands. And, you know, we've got 100,000 to 200,000 people, depending on which numbers you look at, who are dying each year prematurely from air pollution. That's more than are dying from gun violence. That's more than are dying from car crashes. And we know that millions of more folks are actually, you know, getting sick. And we also know that we got 24 million people in our country who have asthma and 7 million kids. And it's African-American and Latinx kids who have been going to the emergency rooms and the ones who have been losing their lives prematurely. So, you know, in this moment, there is a spotlight. There is a direct connection also to these chronic medical conditions and that making people more susceptible to COVID-19. So, you know, hopefully we'll have a conversation also about the stimulus dollars and how they could be better utilized to actually address some of these types of impacts. But, you know, when we have air pollution that's playing a significant role already, even before COVID-19, you know, in shortening people's lives, when we know that, you know, there are people across our country who haven't had access to clean water. when we know we got 500,000 homeless people, and that's the conservative number, who, when we tell folks to go out and wash their hands and use soap, but folks don't have access to this, and we don't do anything, then that's when it gets extremely frustrating. But, you know, we take that frustration and we turn it into, you know, making sure that we're moving forward on the development of the policies and actions and the resources that are going to be necessary.
Let's just talk about some of the data that we do have right now. And, of course, we're still waiting for more data. In Illinois, 43% of people who've died from the disease and 28% of those who've tested positive are African American. This is a group that makes up just 15% of that state's population. African Americans, who account for a third of positive tests in Michigan, represent a whopping 40% of deaths in that state, even though they make up 14%. And then in Louisiana, I mean, another very striking number, 70% of the people who've died are Black, though only one third of the state's population is Black. Beth, what about these numbers?
Yeah, they're very striking. And, you know, I think they have multiple, I think there are multiple causes driving this tremendous disparity. And I think certainly air pollution is one of them. I think you have to start with the fact that African American and Latino and other communities of color are people who are more likely to be working through this pandemic and unable to shelter at home, either because they can't afford to or because they are working in essential jobs and in caring, the caring sector, or transportation, or you know, groceries, supermarket delivery, all those kinds of things. We know that communities of color, people of color, are overrepresented. So they are more exposed to the virus in the first place. And, you know, as we were talking about earlier in the conversation, air pollution is not an equal opportunity risk. It is a risk that affects poor people and African Americans and other people of color more than it affects white Americans. And that is because, you know, as Mustafa's been talking about, you know, these environmental justice issues, you know, historically and very much still today, we see communities of color are exposed to much higher levels of pollution. You know, whatever the pollution source is, whether it's a, you know, a container port or a freeway or a, you know, polluting factory, or in a place like the San Joaquin Valley, you know, a huge agricultural operation. People of color tend to be more exposed to higher levels of air pollution. So we know now from this Harvard data and other studies that that is going to mean a higher risk if you get COVID-19. So I think there's a lot of things at play there.
Mustafa, healthcare is so also directly connected to this. The biotech data firm Rubix Life Sciences, which is in Massachusetts, reviewed recent billing information in several states and found that African Americans with symptoms like coughs and fevers were less likely to be given one of the scarce coronavirus tests.
Yeah, you know, I guess now about 4 weeks ago, I wrote a study or a report, actually, and it was came out in U.S. News and World Report, where I talked about, you know, some of the systemic things that have been going on in our medical system, the biases that exist. We know from previous studies that when it comes to communities of color, they receive less care from some. We know that, you know, when it comes to pain, lots of times it's assumed that communities of color can accept higher levels of pain. So, you know, lots of times folks will be given, you know, something and sent home instead of being admitted and further testing going. We know that, you know, we've got 20 million people in our country who are living in physician deserts. And we know that many communities of color are actually located in medically underserved areas. So all of these things come together to create this toxic soup, if you will, that puts people, you know, in greater jeopardy. And we've got to, you know, finally be willing to actually address what's going on. You know, we still have a set of governors who refuse to move forward on, you know, expansions around Medicaid. And, you know, as was highlighted throughout the Democratic presidential campaign, you know, we've got over 80 million people who are underinsured and uninsured in our country, and we know disproportionately communities of color have a big percentage of that. So you create this situation where, in many instances, folks are afraid to actually go to the doctor. There's been this, and it's starting to change slightly because some folks are being a bit more forward-thinking in some of the steps that need to happen. But, the president shared with folks, if you need to get a test, you can get a test. And that the costs would be covered. Well, what they didn't tell folks was that, yeah, that cost for that particular test may have been covered, but all these other costs that are associated, in this situation is what scares people. And people often, who are barely making it, paycheck to paycheck, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 hit is something that's unacceptable. So people will put off, until the last moment, sometimes going to the doctor because, just afraid that they may have to choose between putting food on the table or being able to pay this medical bill. So we've got to get smarter about how we want to address these issues. And we've got to make sure that everybody is covered from our healthcare system. But we've got to also be focused on these disparities that continue to exist inside of our most vulnerable communities.
Dr. Mustafa Santiago Ali is Senior Vice President for Environmental Justice at the National Wildlife Federation and a member of the Environmental Protection Network. We're also joined today by Beth Gardner, a journalist and author of the book Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. I also just want to mention, and we're going to do a whole show on this, but Mustafa, I appreciate that when you talk about communities of color, you always include indigenous communities. Indian Country Today and a lot of national outlets have been writing about what COVID-19 is exposing in Indian Country. It's really exacerbating so many vulnerabilities on Indian reservations and in Indian Country in general.
It's mind-blowing. Most Americans never have the opportunity to actually be on the reservation, to visit with our indigenous brothers and sisters and see what's going on. We talk about crumbling infrastructures, invisible infrastructures. It's just mind-blowing what has happened on indigenous lands. Literally for some of our indigenous brothers and sisters, they may be hundreds of miles sometimes away from medical care. When we talk about, extreme percentages of individuals not being hooked up to running water, both drinking water and sewage treatment, it is not unusual for a number of the nations and the tribes around our country. And it's unacceptable. There is no reason. And I hope folks will slow down and realize that we are living in 2020. Some of the things that we see still happening in our country is something that we would assume would be happening in 1930 or 40 or the 50s, and it's 2020. So resources have got to be focused on these places that have been unseen and unheard, where there are hardworking people, where there's strong culture, but it's being eroded by all of these challenges that continue to be placed on people's backs on a daily basis.
To your point, Beth, I just found a piece, KNVX. The headline says it all. Navajo Nation running low on water, approaching top three hotspots in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think when you look at the way that the COVID-19 pandemic is playing out, you really do see that it is exploiting and exposing all the sort of weaknesses and pressure points within our country that are all of our sort of pre-existing conditions, whether that's structural racism or whether it's, this extreme inequality that really characterizes the country in recent decades, whether it's all the dysfunctions within the healthcare system, the weaknesses in our supply chains, all these incredibly long global supply chains and that are built for sort of profitability rather than resilience. All these weaknesses are being exposed and exploited by this virus, and the way it's playing out is right along all of those fault lines. And I think it's really important to also look forward and see what the next big pressure and stress is coming down the pike towards us that is also going to play out in exactly the same way on all those same fault lines, and that is climate change. And, you know, we've already seen with some of the extreme weather and storms that we have, whether it's, you know, Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Katrina or, you know, other extreme events, that in very similar fashion, you know, they are not equalizers. They are dividers or exposers of these divisions that already exist, that widen them, you know. In Hurricane Harvey in Houston a couple of years ago, we saw African American and other communities of color impacted, you know, much more severely than white communities. And I think that in some senses, what we are seeing with COVID-19 is a warning of what is to come, and that if we don't start to repair some of these problems in our society, whether it's structural racism, whether it's economic inequality or all these other things, you know, we have another big hit coming at us really soon with the impacts of climate change. We're already feeling it, and it's going to be expressed and experienced along all these exact same fault lines.
Also, Beth, this is a really good time for environmental journalists to really dive deep and write about these issues and make the connections. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of parallels, even if there aren't direct connections. You know, I don't think COVID-19 is a problem that was caused by climate change. Other diseases like Lyme disease and malaria spreading further north, you know, are more associated with sort of temperature change and things like that. But I think there are some really important parallels between this pandemic and climate change. Number one, and the most obvious, is that scientists have been warning us about both of them for really decades now, and our political systems have failed to respond. We did not prepare for the pandemic. It caught us, you know, without all the things that we needed to respond. And I think we're starting to see that with climate change too. And it's also, you know, I spoke to a climate expert last week who said to me, these are both problems of exponential growth. You know, with COVID-19, we have seen state after state and country after country go from, you know, 10 cases to 10,000 cases in a matter of weeks. And with climate change, we are also seeing, you know, our carbon emissions and the impact of them accelerate very rapidly. And the thing about a problem of exponential growth is that you have to take action before you can actually see the consequences. You know, we were talking at the beginning of this conversation about how the Bay Area's really aggressive implementation of shutdown measures before there were very many COVID cases is why San Francisco is now in a better position than New York, which waited. It's the exact same thing with climate change. If you wait to see the impacts, if you wait for the seas to start rising and you wait for the extreme weather to really get bad before you start cutting carbon emissions, it's too late. So I think really one of the biggest lessons we can learn from COVID-19, well, two things. Number one is, you know, listen to science. Take heed of these warnings. And number two is, you know, we have to act aggressively and urgently to prepare and prevent and forestall some of the worst impacts of climate change. And if we do that now, we will benefit from our actions later.
Mustafa, what would you add?
Well, I agree, and I enjoy the work that Beth and others do to actually, you know, help folks to understand, you know, what's going on in the moment and also be prepared for the future. But I would also just reference that both the IPCC and the National Climate Assessment reports had shared with folks, you know, and many people didn't pay as much attention about this aspect about infectious diseases and you know, possibilities of pandemics. Many times folks were looking at vectors, you know, looking at, you know, West Nile, dengue fever, and the various things that mosquitoes and others could bring, and also reference, you know, other things that could be a part of this mix. But I will say this, and I've got a piece that's coming out on it, is that the impacts from climate change, of course, all of us know are happening today and will continue to grow till tomorrow. But I'm worried about what's going to happen over the next few months. We'll be moving into hurricane season here very soon. And I remember because I was on the ground when Katrina and when we were doing, you know, the cleanups and trying to help, and all the people who got pushed into the Superdome. So imagine in this situation, what we have currently going on now, and, you know, tens of thousands of people being displaced and them having to be placed into some types of shelters. How do you make sure that social distancing is happening in that moment? How do we deal with the quarantine situation in that moment? And I have not seen this administration prepared on the basic level for the storms that we've dealt with in the past. How do we deal with the wildfires that will come? And knowing that in many instances, we have prisoners who are a part, of the wildfire fighting force, and our first responders who are part of that, who are dealing with 100 plus degree temperatures in gear, and at the same time then having to worry about exposures to COVID-19. If you are not thinking critically about this, you are putting people's lives in danger. We're moving into the flooding season, and people will be displaced because of that. We just saw what happened with the tornadoes, and yes, tornadoes are not a part of climate change, but we still need to be thinking critically about what's going on. And then I'll just close with...
Mustafa, I'm sorry, I've got to cut you off because we're just out of time, but we would love to have you back. Mustafa, Santiago Ali, and Beth Gardner, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll begin a 3-day series about the world's largest animal processing corporations. We'll begin by learning more about JBS, the world's largest meat company, and Smithfield, the country's largest pork producer. Both companies have had major COVID outbreaks and several workers have died. What do we need to know about the history of these companies, their profits, lobbying, and government subsidies? Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.